KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Upper Castro.
East Oakland.
Lake Mary, Oakland, what's poppin'?
Coming up, we go to a rally in San Francisco where women, especially black women, who've had babies prematurely, are working with researchers to find solutions.
I mean, I don't want to say this in front of her, but there was a point where I was just like, if she doesn't make it, that's it for me.
Then we'll hear about the latest practices being used to help preemies survive.
While our great success led us initially to using invasive technologies, we've realized now that we need to use as little as we can.
And we'll visit the volunteers who help the smallest babies meet the world.
I call cuddling the work of the heart.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Babies being born too early is the number one cause of infant mortality in the United States. Public health officials thought they had turned the corner, but after nearly a decade of decline, preterm birth is back on the rise. Researchers at the University of California, San Francisco are working with mothers from around the Bay Area to determine root causes and solutions. Cassidy Rosenblum reports.
All right, San Francisco, if you're feeling good, let me hear you say ashe.
Ashe!
If you are ready to end health inequities, let me hear you say ashe.
On a recent Thursday evening, close to 50 women and their families gather on the steps of City Hall, waving purple lights and chanting,
40 weeks! 40 weeks!
It's a rallying cry for many there who have experienced preterm birth. That's when a baby is born before 37 weeks.
I was born early. I was a preemie.
Cheyenne is an energetic 8-year-old. She was born at 31 weeks.
So it was really, really, really stressful. Like, there was a point where they weren't sure.
And that's her mother, Shantae Beck.
And, I mean, I don't want to say this in front of her, but there was a point where I was just like, if she doesn't make it, that's it for me.
Beck works with the Preterm Birth Initiative. It's a partnership between researchers at UCSF and women of color who have had preterm births. Nationally, just under 10% of babies are born preterm. But for black women in San Francisco, that number is about 14%. At tonight's rally in honor of World Prematurity Day, the goal is to raise awareness of preterm birth and advocate for health equity. The signs on the steps say things like, "Nothing about us without us," and reflect the group's mission: put women who have actually experienced preterm birth in charge of policy change. Monique Lassar is the executive director of Rafiki Coalition for Health and Wellness, based in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood. Blinking back tears, she calls on the power of story before launching into her own.
My parents were 20 and 21 years old. They lived in poverty in rural Pennsylvania. They had no running water, no electricity. My father had been recently released from 3 years in the federal pen. I was a preemie born in 1970 at 27 weeks.
Lassar says she never considered how her own prematurity affected her before she learned about the Preterm Birth Initiative.
I didn't think about my ADHD, my dyslexia, my weight gain, my depression, my anxiety. I thought they were the legacy of toxic stress, racism, intergenerational trauma, and poverty. I had not added this extra piece. I did not know that in 1970 they didn't talk about babies being born at 27 weeks because they didn't survive.
Babies who survive preterm birth are at risk for a long list of health complications, like cerebral palsy, breathing problems, and learning disabilities. Other countries, like Japan and Canada, fare significantly better than the U.S. Why does the U.S. struggle on this issue, especially when it comes to poor women and women of color? Researchers aren't 100% sure, but women here say they've learned that there's one common denominator.
The overarching issue is stress.
Breanne Taylor also works with the Preterm Birth Initiative. She says while stress can come from a variety of places, one looms largest in the Bay Area.
Stress that comes from inadequate housing, from not knowing if you're going to be evicted from your housing today or if you're even going to get housing tomorrow.
Taylor's asked for City Hall.
We, first and foremost, want a classification for pregnant women. Too often in housing, single people who are pregnant aren't able to apply for the public housing, aren't able to get into the programs with the grants because they aren't yet a family. That interim period is so, so, so important. They cannot be left out.
As the rally drew to a close, singer Amina Ahmad led the crowd in an affirmation. She invoked Oshun, a Yoruba goddess associated with motherhood, and ended with this chant.
And so this song is dedicated to all of those under oppression. And as we all have a belly button, we all come from the goddess. Ashe?
Ashe, the crowd called, waving their violet lights. Ashe, so it will be. In San Francisco, I'm Cassidy Rosenblum for Cross Currents.
From ghetto to die. From ghetto to die. From ghetto to die. Come on. From ghetto to die.
Cassidy is a master's candidate at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. To follow up on that last story, we reached out to Elizabeth Rogers. She's Associate Clinical Director of the Intensive Care Nursery at UCSF, Benioff Children's Hospital. KALW's Ben Trefney sat down with her to hear more about the preterm birth initiative and to learn what technologies and medical techniques are being used to save the most vulnerable premature babies.
So since the preterm birth initiative began a few years ago, what are the goals and outcomes and timeline for the project?
Well, there are several aims that the PTBI is striving to accomplish. And one of them is discovery and one of them is intervention. So we want to learn as much as we can about preterm birth, which can then lead us to developing specific precision-based interventions for babies and for families. But the way that they've approached the research is very innovative and really first of its kind. And what they've done is they've engaged families, true stakeholders in this, to tell them what they care about so that the research can be done with their priorities in mind, so that the work is more relevant, more meaningful to those folks who are really impacted the most by preterm birth.
And more personal.
Absolutely. Learning about their experience and considering them experts in their experience.
So I actually have a personal connection with this because my children, I have twins who are 15 now, but they were premature babies themselves. They were born at just after 31 weeks of gestation, and they were in the UCSF neonatal intensive care unit for 3 weeks. And I had a lot of personal experience with kids who were of all kinds of different ages and all kinds of different conditions, had a lot of different health issues. There was actually a whole other wing besides where my kids were, which is sort of the healthy wing. Just incredible interventions to take place, even fetal surgeries. So I was wondering what you could tell me about the state now and, you know, over the course of UCSF's work of technology and medical work in helping babies survive.
What we think is that truly improvement in technology, particularly around pulmonary technology, so this is breathing, lung development, that was the first step. That's what we needed to figure out in order to increase survival in these babies. And these technologies, particularly, you know, 20 years ago, were pretty invasive. They involved putting a breathing tube into the baby's windpipe, having them breathe on machines.
And we're probably talking about 4-pound, 5-pound babies.
Oh, we're talking about 1-pound babies, 2-pound babies, 3-pound babies. And we found that with these machines, we could support their lungs so that they could develop like they would have if the baby had remained inside, and then eventually we could take them off the machines. But what we increasingly learned over the last decade or two is that these machines that we used to support them also harmed them. And so where our work has really focused the last 10 to 20 years is on brain development. and recognizing that every intervention we have on these really tiny babies who should be inside developing every day, changing, they're then in our care unexpectedly, and we're using machines, they're being touched, they can hear sound, they're seeing lights when they really shouldn't have been. And every interaction they have with their environment can have an impact on how their brain wires itself.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Rogers. She's Associate Clinical Director in the Intensive Care Nursery at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in San Francisco. I've always been really fascinated since I was in the NICU about some of the work that's done to help the most fragile, or, you know, kids who have the most damage that needs to be addressed survive. What's a case that you could think of maybe the smallest baby that you've known that you guys have been able to save?
We have one baby who is now actually almost 10 years old, and she was on a ventilator. So she was on a machine to help her breathing. She was on a special ventilator because her lungs were so fragile.
How early was she?
She was 26 weeks. Oh. So just between 25 and 26 weeks.
Rather than the 40 that is kind of expected, right?
Correct. So 14 weeks early. And she was small as well, even for her young age. And she had a blood vessel in her heart that commonly closes when full-term babies are born. They take a big, deep breath. Their heart realizes, I don't need that blood vessel anymore, and it closes. Well, preemies think they need to hold on to that blood vessel because they don't realize that they're born already. But it can then cause problems for them. So for her, we were constantly weighing, should we do a big surgery and close this blood vessel and try to get her off the ventilator? Or should we talk to her family about the fact that she might not survive? And we had these discussions over the course of weeks. And at one point, we just decided we had to try the surgery.
Meanwhile, I mean, because she was born at that point, right? So how was she kept during that time?
She was in an isolette. So we have small little plastic rooms, almost little beds that babies sleep in. She had a breathing tube in her windpipe on a breathing machine. She had cords and monitors. She had special IVs. She had special lines that went into her umbilical cord. She also had brain injury. She had bleeding on one side of her brain that was on the more severe end. And so her family was confronted with very challenging, impossible decisions that they had to make regarding her care.
And this is a baby that's the size of a doll or something, right?
Oh, tiny. Could fit in the palm of her dad's hand. Mm-hmm. And while we're discussing her, you know, her chances of surviving, we really feel that we can't just discuss survival, that we need to discuss long-term challenges she may have. So we had very difficult discussions. Our job is to be as honest as we can, even when it's really bad news we might be sharing, but to also recognize that we don't have a crystal ball and we can't always predict which preterm babies will have challenges and which won't. So in this case, we decided to go ahead and do the surgery. But within a week, we were able to take her off the breathing machine, and she went home around her due date. And I've been lucky enough to follow her. So she is a brilliant preteen. She speaks three languages. She, because of the bleeding in her brain, does have a very, very, very mild asymmetry in her neurologic exam that if you were not a neurologist, you would never notice. One of the typical things that our babies do have a challenge with is attention and focus. And the way that I explain it to families is because that second trimester is a time that the brain is making all of these connections. These synapses are coming together, and they're truly making millions and millions of them as the brain is rapidly developing. Then the third trimester, they're supposed to prune away the connections they don't need, but because they're exposed to the world, they don't know what to prune away. So they hold on to all these connections. And when you're in second grade and trying to focus on the teacher and your friends are all having conversations, you really pick up on those because you have all this extra firing going on in your brain. So the way I explain it to families is, it's a superhero brain. It's sort of a superpower that you have that you need to figure out how to use for good.
So in the work that you do with the smallest people that there are, literally, what do you find most fulfilling about your job?
I find that walking with parents at this really uncertain time is really rewarding for me. It's very challenging. It can be emotionally difficult. But as long as we're honest with families about our concerns, then we can really share their hopes. And it's such a beautiful relationship to be able to form at a really critical time. And we can take the best care of a baby that we possibly can using all the technology. But if you don't understand how this extreme preterm birth may have impacted this family for the rest of their lives, then we can't fully prepare them for it. Interestingly, one of the most evidence-based practices in neonatology is not steroids or mechanical ventilation or different neuroprotective medications. It's actually putting a baby skin to skin on his mom or dad's chest. And yet we've developed these isolettes, these little plastic beds that they sleep in.
Just even in the name of it, it's like isolation chambers.
Yeah. Outside of their family unit. But then we find, look, if we take them out and put them on their parent, they do better. We need to go back to the basic needs that this baby would have had in utero to be one unit with his mom. So that's really where our efforts are focused. How can we do that in a safe way for our smallest and most vulnerable babies?
Elizabeth Rogers is Associate Clinical Director of the Intensive Care Nursery at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Last year, we asked who your local heroes are. And in response, we got this call.
Hi, this is Paul Watsky of San Francisco. I'm calling with a recommendation for your local heroes program. It's about the Stanford Hospital Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, where volunteers come in and hold babies who would otherwise have to spend all their time in incubators until they were well enough to leave the hospital. In my mind, those are local heroes, and it would be great if you gave them some recognition. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Well, since we're talking about babies today, we wanted to reshare the story we made from Paul's request. KALW's Nicole Grigg went to Stanford Hospital's Neonative Intensive Care Unit, or NICU, to meet these local heroes.
The NICU is a daunting place. It's filled with massive equipment, doctors, nurses, worried parents, and fragile newborn babies. I mean, very fragile. It's a unique space where science and the spirit connect and heal.
We can take babies that are just considered viable, which is 23 to 24 weeks gestation.
Maureen Roberts is a NICU nurse at Stanford Children's Hospital.
We can take care of babies before and after cardiac surgery. We take care of babies that are getting peritoneal dialysis.
For dozens of newborns, this space is home temporarily, but their parents can't always be there to hold and comfort them. That's when a group of trained volunteers fill in with an extra set of hands. They are called cuddlers.
The cuddler program is so great because we all want to see our babies have positive touch and more stimulation and get held more. And it's so nice for us to have the cuddlers come and hold our babies.
People will look at you because we wear blue smocks and they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to see you. We have a baby for you.
That's Claire Fitzgerald. She and her husband, Pat Rice, have been cuddlers for about 20 years.
I call it cuddling the work of the heart.
Stanford Children's Hospital has dozens of cuddler volunteers. Pat is one of very few men who are part of the program. He's known around the NICU for his deep voice and gentle demeanor.
My affect when I sit down to cuddle a baby creates kind of an energy field around the baby and in the environment that we're sitting in. And if I'm irritated, agitated, strained, upset, that's what I'm bringing affectively and emotionally to the baby.
Pat almost has this baritone-like voice, and with the sound of his voice, you know his chest has to be vibrating with the music that comes out of his vocal cords, and he can put any baby to sleep. They just turn to jello.
When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Make no mistake, though, the NICU can be a very stressful place. Some of the kids don't survive. Nurse Maureen says the medical staff and the cuddlers have to navigate through this tough circumstance as well.
Yes, no one should die alone, especially not a baby. It's so important for that baby to be loved and held and supported in those last days of life. I'm always so proud of our cuddlers who don't have a medical background that are so brave. They hold those babies and they comfort those babies. And I've never once had a cuddler say, I can't do this.
It's really hard. That's where I held this beautiful baby. And the nurse asked me to do that because they were having a care conference with the parents and they were going to take off life support. The thing that I guess my reaction to that, too, other than the tears, is I'm really happy that I could give that child comfort for that short period of time.
So what is it like as a parent to have a stranger who's not a medical professional holding and comforting your child? Shay McClendon is a mom. She and her husband David have a 6-year-old girl named Laurel and 3-year-old twins, Oliver and Skye. All of their kids were born prematurely, so the family has spent many, many hours in the Stanford NICU and with the cuddlers. In fact, one child is still on a ventilator and needs round-the-clock at-home medical care. Shay plays with Skye in her family room, and she talks about her first cuddler experience. It was with Pat.
My heart stops. It was just I guess it's Mother Bear coming out, you know, in full force. It was the most awful thing, seeing someone there holding your child. And I didn't know about the cuddler program at this time. But I had to talk to myself for a few seconds while I stood behind him, like, you know, trying to calm myself down, like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And then he turned around and he saw me and he kind of calmed me down. He says, you know, is this okay? I'm holding your child. I'm just comforting her. And I realized I was being silly. And I said, it's absolutely fine. And from that moment, it was okay.
Shay and David stressed that despite the difficult journey through the NICU for years, their family's story is a story of joy. And the cuddlers who nurtured their babies have a lot to do with that.
You know, they actually nurture the whole family, not just your baby. It's you as well.
Shay says once her kids get older, she wants to be a cuddler too. And that's exactly the thought that Claire and Pat had decades ago.
I had had a child in the hospital many years ago, and they thought he had a brain tumor. Fortunately, he didn't, but I was one of these worried moms, and I said, when my hair turns gray, I'll come back and say thank you, because I thought that was a great way to give back to the community.
The sky is always blue, but when you're crying...
The cuddler program at Stanford Children's Hospital has been around for more than 20 years, and it's still going strong. And it will continue to, so long as there are people like Pat and Claire and Shay who want to pay it back and pay it forward.
The whole world, it smiles with you.
In the South Bay, I'm Nicole Grigg for Cross Currents.
That story was inspired by a call from listener Paul Watsky, who recommended the Cuddlers as local heroes. Do you have people whose work should be recognized here in the Bay Area? Give us a call and tell us about them. The number is 415-264-7106 and leave a message. Again, that number, 415-264-7106. And that's our show today. Our team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Angela Johnston, Christine Nguyen, Truk Nguyen, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko, Gabe Graben, and James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. You can catch blues and soul musicians Freddie Hughes and Chris Burns play at the Royal Cuckoo in San Francisco. That's this Wednesday at 7:30. And the show is free. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
I don't know what I want, but I know I want something.